Welcome to each of you.
Standard person Tyler Green on behalf of respondents, the governor, lieutenant governor, and Justin Lee.
Welcome.
Eric Weeks and Christine Gilbert on behalf of the respondents and legislature.
Welcome. Okay, I understand that the petitioners will be taking 15 minutes for your opening statement, with Mr. Maxfield to take 9 minutes, Mr. Newby 3, and Mr. Grant 3. We'll then hear from the respondent, with Mr. Purser taking 10, and Mr. Weeks 10. Then on rebuttal, you'll have 5 minutes to be divided as you wish. We have assigned these time limits, but as long as we're still asking questions, we have these oral arguments so that we can become educated about these cases. So if we're still asking questions, you may continue and go over your time. And it won't cut into each other's time. It won't cut into your rebuttal. The same will be true for the respondent. So let's begin then with Mr. Maxfield.
Yes.
Oh, I'll also note for the record that Justice Pierce is recused in this matter, and we're pleased to be joined by Judge Kate Appleby of our Court of Appeals.
Good morning, Chief Justice Durant, Justice of the Supreme Court, and Justice Appleby. The Utah Constitution was adopted in 1896. 4 years later, Utah was the second state in the nation to ratify and establish initiative and referendum, which became Article 6, Section 1 of the Utah State Constitution. Upon adoption, Henry Lawrence aptly opined, "The great trouble now will be get to the legislature to adopt legislation to make it effective, as our legislature will be opposed to the principle." True to form, it took 16 years to get the first enabling legislation. As we pointed out in Petitioner Grant's brief, the legislature has since that time opposed the principle by passing ever-increasing and hostile restrictions, even in eliminating certain rights. This court has held in Krajicek versus Saratoga Springs, Severe Power versus Hansen, the legislature has gone too far. In Gallivan v. Walker, this court held the right to vote on an initiative cannot exist without the voters' unfettered right to legislate through initiative. And that is why we're before this court today. And I'll set just a quick little background. We get into questions. I'm sure that you have a lot of questions. I'm hopefully able to address them.
Mr. Maxfield, are any of the petitioners individuals who did not seek to file a referendum?
I don't understand the question.
You also sought, you individually signed up seeking a referendum.
Correct.
I'm wondering if any of the other petitioners at the table that will speak today are of the class of petitioners that did not seek to file a referendum.
They're all of the class that filed to seek a referendum.
Who would speak then? Perhaps you can address it on behalf of the challenged class of petitioners, of pro se litigants, who are alleged not to have standing as a result of not having, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I believe that would be Daniel.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm just going to get the background, let's get into the questions and arguments. Basically, we outlined in our extraordinary writ for relief 15 through 34 more fully, but the basically what happened is we had Proposition 2 that was passed by a majority of the voters, and it took effect December 1st. Within 48 hours of taking effect at the very first opportunity to call a special session, that was undone by House Bill 3001-6 substitute. Now, how absurd of this is the holding of this court is basically the legislature can enable time, place, and manage. They can place burdens, but once they become undue burdens, then we've got an issue. The other issue, we go into Gallivan versus Walker, is they become the only game in town. Just to show you that they're the only game in town, there was a 28-page initiative, which was Prop 2, which was passed by the voters. Very open process. In response, there was a 220-page boxcar bill without a public reading, from my understanding, through the hearing process. It was suspended. that was replaced it. Now, if the citizens want to rerun this initiative, we're prohibited from doing so until the 2022 election by the codes they placed us on. So very clearly, what the citizens wanted under Proposition 2, page 28, has been thrown out the window. Now, the first argument we make, and we're going to get into questions, and our argument, first prayer of release, has to do with a special session called by the governor and the ultimate adoption of House Bill 3001 that was signed into law December 3rd. Now, this is broke down into two parts. The constitutional authority of the governor to call the special session regarding an enacted citizens initiative and the legislature passing the 220-page boxcar bill to amend it, and that's their language. Now, as we get to the first argument, we're going to turn into Article 7, Section 6, which states that the governor, on extraordinary occasions, may call to convene the legislature. Now, what's important to note is this is the exact same verbiage used in the U.S. Constitution. It was adopted verbatim for the president to call. Now, this writ, which is Exhibit I in our go-ahead, our extraordinary writ, is a proclamation by the governor. Now, he goes in that writ, and it backs up the argument that it isn't, I can just call a special session for any reason, it calls extraordinary occasions. In that, it says, whereas since the adjournment of the 2018 general session of the 62nd legislature of the state of Utah, certain matters have arisen which require immediate legislative action. So he's stating in there that, hey, there's got to be some exigent circumstances. He lists three reasons that, not reasons, but subject matters. One was the initiative, which nothing had changed. That had been open, that had been locked down since 2017 when they filed the application, when the governor certified it in 2018. When the only thing that had changed between the general session and calling the special session was the voters had voted, and that's not unordinary. I'm going to skip my next part, and I'm going to skip, you know, Black's Law Dictionary is just extraordinary, is out of the ordinary, exceeding the usual. I have not found a lot of case law on what extraordinary occasion is. Now, before you and the petitioners, the only thing I could find that would go to this is a 1947, if I can find it.
Have you found a case where a court has invalidated legislation because a governor invoked an extraordinary session?
No, I have not, Your Honor.
The argument from the other side is that this is a political question that we have no right to interfere with. What do you say in response?
And I say it is a right because there is a constitution, just like the constitutional protection, the initiative referendum right, the Constitution places restrictions on
the separation of powers recognizes that there are certain times when the court needs to stand down as well.
Absolutely, and I don't believe this is one of those times.
But can you tell me why you don't think it's one of those times? I mean, if this is, it seems to me that you're asking the court to do something, you're asking the court, no pun intended, right, to do something extraordinary.
Absolutely, and I believe it goes to this court's holding Gallon versus Walker that initiative and a referendum right are sacred nuts rights, and it's this court's duty to hold them in volatile, you know, and to resolve even constitutional questions in favor of the people being able to exercise that right. So I believe this is one of those extraordinary occasions.
Before we get to the merits of your argument, we have to decide whether this is something that should have gone to the district court first. Can you give us the reasons that this case should come straight to us and shouldn't go first to the district court?
Absolutely. Two reasons. Number one, on a referendum application, if that was successful and this court was to reverse and say you have the right to the referendum, we had a very short time frame, only 45 days to gather those signatures. That was in the statute, and that was the first reason in, I guess, our emergency motion for writ of relief that we included in those. The second reason, we'll go back to this court's holdings and findings in Anderson v. Bell, and I think it's point five, is we're arguing under Rule 65, what gives us the right to be before the court? And the court held in that case, under Rule 65C, that there was I could probably find it here, but there was the state actors were the governor or lieutenant governor that either acted or did not act based upon the statutory code. And I could find that exact site, but I believe if you look at that, I think that very clearly here, there is There is a code that we disagree with the implementation and also constitutional questions.
Now that you have a situation where the lieutenant governor did not allow the referendum, and so you don't have that same time crunch because of the 40 days, could you take this issue to the district court first?
I don't believe that we could.
Okay, what is the reason for that?
One is I believe that the rest of the case is supported here. And number two is I believe that this is the court that would have to make the order reinstating that time frame.
Okay. You have a few different arguments about the lieutenant governor's decision to not certify the referendum. It seems like we need to get over the hurdle of that two-thirds vote first, because before we get to the argument that, which I think you've made a good argument about limiting sponsors to someone who has voted in the last 3 years. The Constitution says legal voters, so that's definitely limiting that group. But before we get to that, because the legislature did do that two-thirds vote, and there's language in the Constitution that that basically saves
down 30 seconds. Can I really try to quick answer the question?
You know what? You have all the time because since I'm asking you a question, you have all the time you need to answer that. But so how do we get over that hurdle that we have that language in the Constitution about when the legislature votes by two-thirds that the citizens don't get to put that up for a referendum?
Absolutely. And I agree with you, Your Honors, that is the crux of the case, and that is the hardest argument to overcome. But without overcoming that argument, as the legislature has been applying it, the initiative referendum power, or the initiative power, is dead, clearly illusionary, and just advisory. So I think it's one that we ought to spend some time on and actually look at, and maybe even if you want to do some additional briefing, because that is the core of what I had to get to here. And we have two concerns. It's your 20A1702, which is a statutory interpretation. It's a derivative of Article 6, Section 1. And why it's close, it's not exact. And it bears strict scrutiny. Now, if it was just a legislative code, we'd look at legislative intent. But since this is legislative inaction, a constitutional provision, which is a creature of the people, which had the organic right to govern, which, you know, puts it forward, I think that a strong bearing looks at the constitutional code under Article 6, Section 1. Now, if we look at that Article 6, Section 1 very closely, and I think that the point that I'm going to make is under paren 2, paren A, paren I, and then you have A and B. And those are talking about the rights. They're talking about initiative rights, and they're talking about a referendum right. And clearly between them, there's this big or, saying you have this initiative right, or you kind of have this referendum right. The initiative rights, your power to enact legislation, which it says here, initiate any desired legislation, cause it to be submitted to the people of adoption upon a majority vote, those voting legislation is provided by statute, and be adopted. So it's going to be enacted. Okay, that's the intent. Now, when I'm going to that intent right there, and I think this is important, and I'll get to it, the legislature passed a bill this year that no initiative takes effect until 60 days after the legislation says secession. So no legislation is going to take effect without them amending it, which we're going to have a problem there in the future. But they're talking about the initiative power, and then or the referendum. It seems to me the constitutional intent, that's separate. The people, you have your power to initiate, and the legislative, during your sessions and things that you do, we have the ability to check and balance. I don't think it was ever intended, and it's absurd to read that we do an initiative that we'd have to immediately do a referendum because all effect it's been vetoed, it's been repealed, it's unrecognizable. And then the people who took 17 months to gather 116,000 signatures within 45 days have to repeat the same process. I think it's unconscionable. The next argument I'm going to make is not everything in the Constitution is constitutional or sacred or there or is left without interpretation. We had the 3/5 of the Indians would only be counted. We have the polygamy issue, which could probably be struck down. We've had a lot of those issues that as we move forward. Utah was the second state in the nation to put this into play. It's never really been implemented. It's not co-equal. It's not coextensive. It's not concurrent. And it isn't the same dignity. So as we go to that two-thirds, it is a very difficult argument. But if we can't get past that, the initiative power ceases to be.
I don't understand that argument. I mean, you have the initiative power. It's just a limit on the referendum. And it's, I mean, it's, you can still bring the initiative, but at some point, I mean, it's of equal dignity. It's in the Constitution as well. I mean, how do you say that your right to initiative trumps the right to preclude referenda if it's passed by a two-thirds supermajority of both branches or both houses?
I don't believe that it trumps. I believe to be concurrent and co-equal, we should have the same ability as...
But you've rendered it meaningless then, right? You're saying it can't apply. When could it ever apply?
Well, what I'm saying is what's meaningless is the initiative process.
Because you can still bring the initiative. I mean, I think there are other arguments. I'm not sure that I agree that this is the best argument. But tell me, in your world, how you've not rendered that provision of the Constitution meaningless.
The two-thirds?
Yeah.
No, I don't, because I believe it applies
to
legislation that is originally initiated by the legislature, not in response to a citizen's initiative. I believe that their budgets, everything that we haven't done an initiative, which is 99.9%, the two-thirds still applies.
I'm not sure that I see that distinction. I mean, there's nothing in the language that suggests that to me.
Okay, and?
Am I missing something in the language?
I don't know if we're missing something in the language in your interpretation. I think we're missing something in
You're arguing, I mean, I take your point is maybe it's such a horse collar on the initiative right that we need to reconcile them, and you're offering me a way in which to reconcile it. But I'm not sure that it's based in the actual language of the Constitution as opposed to some common sense.
And I appreciate that, Your Honor, and that might be a reason to call for extra briefing because there's other points that I believe that can't be made.
Thank you, Mr. Maxfield. Mr. Newby? Or Mr. Grant, would you like to proceed first?
Go ahead. Thank you. I would just as soon as let Steve have all of my time. I'm here because of my 30-year history with the initiative and referendum process. So I can best address issues that deal with the actual workings of the law. And basically how the laws that the legislature passes to restrict the citizens' rights affect the people who actually go out to collect signatures. And I've submitted another exhibit this morning that adds to the memorandum that I have in support that I presented earlier that lists the changes that the 2019 legislature has made to further restrict the initiative and referendum process.
And those may be all fairly subject to constitutional challenges, but that's not fairly in front of us right now, is it?
Okay. But it does go to the point that, the legislature is, they basically have become the only legislative game in town. There was a day when, citizen volunteers could go out and collect enough signatures and earn a spot on the ballot with their issue. You don't see that happening today. It takes a well-funded organization and paid professionals to gather the signatures and bring an issue to the ballot. So effectively, what I'm saying is in the past and even currently, they are legislating the rights of the people to bring initiatives to the ballot. And if it's true that the power of the people to legislate through initiative and referenda are co-equal, co-extensive, and concurrent and share equal dignity, then why aren't these same restrictions applied to the legislature? The biggest one that I wanted to address is the six-year requirement, basically, to bring an issue back to the people again. I'll say that in 2016 and earlier, organizations began laying groundwork for Proposition 2. In 2017, in June, they filed the initiative. By April of 2018, they finished collecting their signatures, and the voters voted for that in November of 2018. Under 20A7-202, The citizens are barred from applying for a similar initiative until April 2020. So it wouldn't be on the ballot again until the November 2022 election. Legislators can bring the same subject multiple times during the same session and year after year. Why are the citizens restricted from, you know, for a six-year period? And with that, if you have any questions on the process, on how the process applies to the citizens, I'll be happy to answer those, because I'm one of the people who have been on the streets collecting signatures for 30 years, and I know how it works.
Thank you, Mr. Grant.
Thank you.
Mr. Newby.
Mr. Newby, can you answer the standing argument with respect to the second class of petitioners that the legislature made? Do you know what I'm referring to?
To the fact that I was rejected from the petition.
So, no, there, as I understand counsel's argument, there are those individuals who sought referendum, and they don't challenge the standing of that class of individuals, but then there's a second class of petitioners who didn't seek the referenda. And the legislative council argues that class do not have standing to participate. So I take it none of the three of you are actually of that class.
No, I did not vote for Proposition 2. I did not vote for it.
Not quite the same issue. I got you. Sorry.
I did not vote in the election.
I don't think that's the issue the legislature was raising, but.
Well, I think the answer I would give to, I think what you're asking is that, you know, in Meyer versus Grant, they talk about core political speech. And I think that separating people into different classes like that in these cases is not justifiable. I think that Buckley versus American Constitutional Law Foundation backs that up.
There's a notion, though, that the laws, general laws of general effect, that not every citizen has. I mean, every citizen then would have standing to challenge them, and that's not the way it works. So for those that didn't seek the referendum but are only petitioning or challenging the initiative process itself or what happened to the initiative, council suggests they don't have standing because they don't have traditional standing, and they also don't have alternative standing. And
doesn't that conflict, though, with Gallivan versus Walker? The voter's right to initiate does not commence at the ballot box.
Gallivan doesn't deal with standing. You might note that's a case I know something about if you look at who argued Gallivan before this court.
It's Article 1, Section 24.
But it doesn't deal with standing. There's nothing in Gallivan that I think that speaks to this particular standing argument. Sorry.
Okay. We'll try to address that later. For me, I've already mentioned Meyer versus Grant. Like those who voted in 2018, I was told to go sit in the back of the political bus because I refused to exert my political vote and power the way the defendants wanted me to. I think that Meyer versus Grant and Buckley versus American Constitutional Law Foundation both defend my core political speech guaranteed to me. I think Gallivan versus Walker does the same, that all laws of a general nature shall have uniform operation, that the legislature be restrained from the fundamentally unfair practice of classifying persons in such a manner that those who are similarly situated with respect to the purpose of the law are treated differently by that law to the detriment of some of those classified. We talked about the right not just commencing at the ballot box. And if those sorts of things are not sufficient, we can go even back to Utah's Enabling Act, which requires that the Constitution shall be Republican in form and not to be repugnant to the principles of the Declaration of Independence. Regardless where we look, how far we go back, the principles are the same. Citizens have the inalienable right and duty to alter or reform the government, and to do so, as you stated in Gallivan versus Walker, effectively, co-equally, co-extensively, concurrently, substantively, via meaningful participation in enacting legislation that impacts society with superior advantages to the legislature and sharing equal dignity. And I think, as Bart as Bart Grant testified, this process has disintegrated and is not reflective of the spirit of the Constitution.
Are you saying that not voting for you, you're a legal voter, you're registered to vote, but you've chosen not to vote. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that that is expression, that that's part of your free speech?
Absolutely,
right?
That is expression. Absolutely.
So for them to limit it to active voters or voters who have voted in the last, if it's, you're still legally registered as a voter, but you've chosen to express yourself by whatever you're intending to say, your message is, you're boycotting it, or whatever you're intending to express, that's problematic to limit it to active voters.
Yes,
it is. I think you have a good argument on that point.
And I'd like to back that argument up, actually. That's a perfect question. I worked for nearly 4 years to prevent the legislature from gutting Initiative B that was passed by roughly 70% of the Utah voters in 2000. And as director of operations for the Sutherland Institute, as co-founder of Accountability Utah, and as a private citizen, I helped the Institute for Justice come to Utah and file a notice of claim. My name was on that notice of claim to pressure Mark Shurtleff and David Yoakum and the other district attorneys to comply with Initiative B and surrender hundreds of thousands of dollars back to the Uniform School Trust Fund. I spent countless hours organizing town hall meetings across the state to warn the people what the legislature was attempting to do to Initiative B. I and a few others pressured the then Senator John Valentine in front of a majority of his partisan delegates down in Utah County to abandon his horrible bill, and then I later confronted Shurtleff on the steps of the Capitol to stop the bill he was trying to regurgitate. In front of news cameras, I stuck my finger an inch from Shurtleff's nose and said, "You are unfit for office," and I did that a long time before everybody else knew he was unfit for office, and believe me, they only know half the story. I long ago paid the price in spades to stand here and to determine the time, manner, and place of my political involvement and not be roadblocked by a bunch of illegitimate, childish statutes that they just concoct out of thin air. And it really upsets me that I have to even say this. But the other thing I want to point out is that this process,
I'll let you make this one last point.
Okay.
And your time is up.
This process has disintegrated into what Gallivan versus Walker warned us about. It warned us that if we don't protect it, it can only be perceived as illusory, emasculated, constricted, confiscated, unequal, violated, ineffective, fettered, unduly burdened, full of reasonable doubt, and illegitimate. And I'm not alone. According to Exhibit F, the Lieutenant Governor's office estimates that there are some 1 million people who didn't vote. They refused to vote. And they're eligible to vote. They refused. And now, in the last few months, they have ticked off. They have destroyed the trust of a 500,000 other people who voted for Proposition 2. This is a crisis not just constitutionally, but of legitimacy in government. And we have to address this. 1.5 out of 2 million voting eligible Utahns are having serious doubts about our collective legitimacy here. How long are they going to be able to keep ratcheting down the screws on this process until somebody says, enough is enough? Yank the choke chain hard and say, no, you have way crossed the line here. You've gone way over the line. Look at the mess you've made in the people's yard. Somebody has to stop this, or it is all just, you have to win the people. They have to believe that this is legitimate. If they don't believe it, it doesn't matter. It isn't legitimate. And with that, I'll close it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Newby. Mr. Purser.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. The court should deny the petition for two reasons. First, petitioners haven't met their burden under Rule 19 to show that they have no other plain, speedy, and adequate remedy in district court. Most of the relief they request is essentially declaratory judgments. And as the court is aware, the district courts have jurisdiction to resolve declaratory judgment actions. Even if they could only proceed by extraordinary writ, they haven't explained why that writ couldn't be filed in district court. None of their arguments would justify extraordinary writ relief from this court. They assert three primary arguments. First, the governor did not veto Prop 2. He convened a special session where the legislature passed HB 3001. The governor then signed it.
What does extraordinary occasions mean?
It's a good question that, first of all, hasn't been briefed. And that would be their burden if they wanted relief from this court to brief that issue. Secondly, it could mean various things. Extraordinary could mean outside of the ordinary time that the legislature meets, and that's what a special session is. I think under any meaningful definition of what extraordinary means, the whole circumstances behind Prop 2 and HB 3001 would meet.
Why couldn't you just wait till the general session? Well, what was so extraordinary that it had to take place the day after?
Well, if the legislature saw issues or problems.
Yeah, what were they?
Well, I'll let co-counsel speak to that as he represents the legislature. But as I understand it, in past years, there had been some attempts to introduce bills on medical marijuana, and they had not gone anywhere. This year,
I mean, we can wait for the legislature. I'm just wondering, what was it that was so extraordinary about this that on the day after the special session needed to be called, convened in order to alter the bill?
I think just the topic in general. This is the first time that the state would be faced with a medical marijuana law. To me, that's extraordinary. It's never happened before. I think that satisfies
any
definition.
I take the
definition.
Point about the political question right. Point is a really interesting one. But I think if we move beyond that and we get into the, you know, start making substantive assessments, I mean, maybe that's why it is political question is perfectly appropriate here. Second, can the legislature can amend an initiative under the statute, but can they amend it to the point of non-existence? I mean, the governor can't veto the bill, and you only, as a legislative body, only have the right to amend. But the effective argument here is that you've amended it to the point that it's not a bill. So, I mean, at some point, it seems to me it's a valid argument. If you amend it, we can't overturn it. So what we do is we amend it to say it is not effective under any circumstance, and then we pass it by two-thirds, effectively nullifying it. Why isn't that a good argument?
Well, first, one, I don't think it's been articulated or argued.
Maybe
that way.
Not in that exact way. That's true. But that is the nut, isn't it, of what they've been arguing, is that they've effectively... this session effectively has taken away the initiative.
Well,
this initiative.
To your specific point, there would need to be briefing that, in fact, HB 3001 amended Prop 2 to the point that not a single word.
Yeah, that it amended it out of existence.
Right.
You're absolutely
and
right about
there's
that.
None of that here.
So
and
let's say, hypothetically, whether it happened here or not, do you agree that the word amend in 20A7-212-3B, does that place some limits on what the legislature can do with an initiative? Could they just pass a bill that says no medical marijuana? We reverse whatever the citizens just did, we reverse it. Can they do that, or do they have to preserve the spirit of what the citizens passed?
Certainly, there's a difference between amend and repeal, and at some point, the legislature has to recognize that difference.
That strikes me as a much more difficult question than you're giving it credit for. I mean, one thing our cases have said, and it seems implicit in the structure of the Constitution, is that the people share the legislature's power. Certainly one legislative body can repeal the legislative handiwork of a prior legislature. So I think this is an interesting question that Justice Peterson has raised and Justice Simonis pointed to, but I'm not sure it has an obvious answer. It certainly
I agree. It doesn't have an obvious answer, and I think that's part of the problem here, is it hasn't been briefed and isn't squarely before this court to be addressed.
That's fair.
Second, and they also argue, well, to put it more bluntly, what they're asking for is prohibited by the Constitution in Article 6, Section 1. They do not have the power to refer a law to be repealed by the people, but when that law is passed by two-thirds of both houses.
What do you say in response to the argument that to reconcile that provision with the initiative provision, you should understand the two-thirds supermajority limitation is applying not to legislation that is prompted by the initiative?
Well, one is the court questioned them that there's no real textual support for that, and they have not entirely articulated that argument either. And two, I don't think they're in conflict. The court's case law has said that they share a co-equal power with the legislature, but the court has also clarified that that power is not all the legislative power. It's simply the power to do what Article 6, Section 1, Subpart 2 says. They have the power to initiate legislation, which this court has long recognized as qualified. Likewise, they have the powers of referendum, which is also expressly qualified by the terms of the Constitution. So I don't see a conflict. This is the way the frame, well, this is not the framers, but in 1900 when this was enacted, passed, and adopted into our Constitution, these were the terms.
So, and I maybe I shouldn't be asking you this. I'll ask this to everyone. I'm not sure which one of you I should address this to. But is there anything that legal voters can do to protect an initiative that they have passed from being changed by the legislature? What can they do if they want it to stay intact in the way that they have passed it? Do they have any protection from the legislature just changing it?
Not by way of initiative. Again, their power, they're not being treated in this respect any worse than the legislatures whose bill could be amended or repealed in a special session.
It seems the problem with that, though, is that the legislature is changing its own statute. And I realize an initiative has the status of a statute, just like right. a law passed like the legislature. So these are all statutes, and legislatures can change statutes. But on the other hand, in the Utah Constitution, legal voters have legislative power. And if the legislature can effectively change anything that the people pass, has that nullified that right? Is it essentially an empty power?
No, it's not, for two reasons. One, the Constitution says they have the power to initiate any desired legislation. It says nothing about that the initiative is sacrosanct, that it takes on some quasi-constitutional status that can't be amended. I've read, I don't have statutes or cases for the court, but I've read in other states where they do have provisions. I think in North Dakota, there's a 7-year limit on what the legislature can do. A few other states have 2-year limits that are subject to supermajorities. So there are those types of limits that could have and could be built into our Constitution, but they're not here.
So it just seems strange that when we get legislation that limits the procedures that people who are trying to sponsor an initiative have to follow, or it creates new rules, we scrutinize those and we look to whether they create an undue burden on the voters' right to initiate. But then when it comes to this, it's Well, sorry, the legislature can do anything and entirely wipe away a law that was actually passed by citizens. Should we scrutinize that at all? Is there a certain point where the legislature would go beyond a line that they are basically nullifying the right to initiative through their actions?
There conceivably could be, but that's not here, and they haven't even made an undue burden argument in their petition.
Is that relevant at all? Not that they've not made it, but is any undue burden analysis relevant here? Should we conduct any sort of analysis like that?
You know, the cases, the court's undue burden cases, as far as I can tell, always focus on the right of initiative. I haven't seen one applied to the referendum right. Could it apply? I suppose so. I think in general, as we've argued in other cases, that we disagree with the undue burden test for reasons that Justice Lee has articulated in a concurring opinion. But that aside, I am not sure how that test applies here. And again, they haven't argued that it should be applied here. My time is up. If there's no further questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Purser. Mr. Weeks.
Chief Justice, Justice of the Supreme Court, may it please the court, Eric Weeks on behalf of the legislature and 104 current and former legislative respondents. Our brief addresses many of the issues discussed here today, including our position that individual legislators are immune from this action based upon legislative immunity under the state.
Before we get to that argument, don't we have to address the standing argument as a threshold matter?
I think we do, Your Honor, and our position is the same as the executive branch respondents, as that stands. We believe that the Class 2 petitioners have standing. The Class 1 petitioners, as we've expressed in our brief, do not have traditional standing. And
haven't made enough of a showing to satisfy the alternative standing test.
That's correct, Your Honor. On the legislative immunity question, the Utah Constitution's Speech and Debate Clause protects legislators from being called into court to answer for their purely legislative actions. I'll leave our brief to explain that position unless there are other questions. What I'd like to focus on today is the legislature's constitutional authority to legislate, which I think is at the core of this matter. This case involves a citizen initiative that qualified for the ballot, was placed on the ballot for the people's vote back in November, and then took effect as law once the people voted in favor of this initiative. The legislature then convened a special session that was called by the governor and amended the code, including some of those provisions that were enacted by the legislature, by the initiative. All of these actions were taken in the normal course of legislative action, of the executive branch's action of calling a session on matters that the governor would like the legislature to comment on and act on.
Is there anything that citizens can do to protect a voter-passed initiative from being changed by the legislature?
And I think there's a lot of things they can do, but I think most of them come, Your Honor, in the area that was addressed by Gallivan, bringing an issue to the voters to have the voters say on. In almost every respect, an initiative that is enacted into, what I want to emphasize here is Gallivan deals with qualifying for the ballot. This initiative qualified for the ballot, along with three others, and three others were voted on by the people and became law. Once that becomes law, if we're talking co-equal powers, that needs to be treated the same way for, that's a parallel situation to an individual legislator who may have a bill that they build consensus for, they put in the public idea and political sphere, and have their colleagues vote on that. There is nothing to protect that legislator, just as there is nothing to protect the sponsors of an initiative to having some other group or constituency come up with a different idea and use the process of legislation to enact that.
Problem
idea.
Is they're not co-equal in structurally. We say they're co-equal, but in some sense, it's the fox in the hen house, isn't it? Because the people don't get to really trump what the legislature does, but the legislature gets to trump what the people do.
There are checks and balances, Your Honor.
So what is the check from the – well, I take it back. I guess the check from the people side is simply voting the individual representatives out of office. That's the ultimate check.
Legislators serve at the whim of their constituents.
I got you.
I mean, that's the real answer to Justice Peterson's question, right? I mean, people can vote in favor of an initiative and then can put all kinds of political pressure on their elected representatives. And then if their elected representatives don't bow to that pressure, the next election cycle, they vote them out of office. That's the answer, right?
Absolutely. And just speaking the facts of this, Your Honor, this is a case where an initiative was enacted into law. Prior to this initiative, the only access to medical cannabis essentially was for a terminal patient in the last 6 months of that patient's life. Once this initiative passed, that was a substantive change. I mean, if you look at the facts, there is a much, much broader access to medical cannabis as a result of the initiatives, even after the amendments made by the legislation, by the legislature.
What would you say about the word amend in 2A7-212-3B? Where it says the legislature may amend any initiative approved by the people at any legislative session, does that place limits on what the legislature is allowed to do?
I would differ from my executive branch respondents on that, Your Honor. This is a core legislative power. The legislative's plenary powers are to legislate. We amend amendments done in the legislative process often repeal things, often change them entirely. It's an extremely difficult position to put not only the legislature but even more so the court to decide whether political actions taken by a majority vote of the legislature essentially nullify or repeal a law.
So the legislature says amend, not nullify or repeal, but you're asking us to read amend as nullifier, including nullifier repeal.
That is how we would read it within our branch. The amendment would include everything.
That makes almost no sense to me. I mean, I can understand a constitutional argument to that provision, but the legislature clearly knows the difference between an amendment and repealing a statute, yet specifically chose to use only the verb to amend.
And Your Honor, I would argue that we have multiple amendments that result in appeal of an enacted provision, and that's how we would read that.
Yeah, but you don't have, that may be the case, but you don't have legislation in that case saying you can only amend, right? I mean, if we do a plain language, you think under a plain language analysis, amend includes repeal?
And Your Honor, I think that would be something we would need to brief.
I'm just asking you standing here, do you think amend includes repeal?
I think it does, Your Honor.
So you're saying in practice it does. If we were to look at the meaning of the term, I don't know the definition off the top of my head, but do you think that if we were looking textually at the meaning of amend, would it include repeal? Or from your experience, amendments often do repeal. But I'm not sure we don't have a definition in front of us.
I think it's an accurate way to state it. And again, I'm going purely on conjecture because I don't think this was raised by the petitioners. This wasn't briefed by us. Certainly there are excellent textual arguments that amend and repeal are very different words.
You're arguing it's things. A term of art in the legislative
Within
context,
the legislature, when we like say amend, it has a very broad reading, Your Honor. And Your Honors, absent further questions, for the reasons stated and pled, we request that the court dismiss this position. And also find that as it relates to the individual legislator respondents, that they are entitled to legislative immunity in this type of action.
Well, we don't need to do that if we dismiss it, do we?
No, Your Honor. Okay. I believe you don't get to that
All right.
question.
Thank you, Mr. Weeks. Is it Mr. Maxfield?
Mr. Maxfield, it seems fair that the question that perhaps Justice Peterson and I have been focusing on is not really been briefed. And that is whether the language to amend within the statute section, what is it, 212, whether or not it includes a repeal, first, and second, whether this was in fact an effective repeal.
And I think that's a fair question I'd like to address just really quickly. On your point about Class 1 of voters, is Class 1 had only voted?
Yes.
There's nobody here to speak to that standing, but the court only allowed three people. We had a discussion. There's many people.
I don't want you to take it as being critical. I just think when somebody raises a standing argument, it's a threshold question
that needs
to be addressed.
It is, and there's nobody here to address that. Daniel got confused because he was addressing the class of voter that could do a referendum.
I asked a really bad question.
I think it was a great question, Your Honor. And I also
you know how to play to the audience.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate your candor. But let me be just as candid with you on 28.7.2.12, parent 3. It says, the governor may not veto a law adopted by the people, and the legislature may amend any initiative approved by the people at any legislative session. That was not derived by initiative. It was not derived by the people. It was not derived by the Constitution. It was just simply some restriction, or in this case it might be an restriction, but it's a power that creates a restriction by the legislature that's very self-serving. And I love Galvin versus Walker, and I still can't even get it. I love that case. But again, and you know this better than I do, it says the power the legislature has to pass legislation that aids and facilitates the initiative power intended by the Constitution, no legislation shall be enacted to restrict, hamper, or impair the exercise of the right reserved to the people, Galvin versus Walker. Now, I understand there's a lot of parentheses that put initiative, but I also believe that same power is the referendum power. And so I believe that law there, 20A7-212-3B, in this context, the way it's being used has got to be narrowly construed as using it to restrict a initiative right. And the reason that I'm going to say that is, we're going to go back to that, is by any, it says, initiative approved by the people at any legislative session. They just gave themselves an extra right. Doesn't matter. We have that right. And the rights come from the people. There's one other point that I'd like to address that Justice Lee brought up. And it's in Galvin versus Walker. If you undermine the right to vote on initiative, you really undermine the right to vote for a representative. The way we work is we vote for a representative. And just like they're arguing over here that the legislature is immune from what they say during the legislative session. We're not suing them for what they said. It's for what they did or didn't do under the 65 BC. They're immune from that. Just like candidates running from office are fairly immune to what they say. They tell us one thing and they go do something else. Because of the special interest in the state of Utah, no campaign finance limits for $27,000 buys you access, gets you $1 million of tax breaks. So after years and years and years of this platitude and this service and the right to vote and exercising and nothing changes, the people maintain a separate right. It's a creature of people reserved in themselves. And this court has held in Severe Power versus Hansen, it's not about whether it's complicated, it's not about whether it's wise for the people to set legislative priorities, but it is their right. And what the legislature failed to address in Article 6, Section 1, Paren A, is we can initiate any legislation and cause it to be adopted by the vote of the people. And that is what's done here. So the question before the court is, does 20A7212 paren 3 paren B give the legislature to use that process to immediately undo what was adopted by the people? Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Macfield. Thank you to each of you and to all parties and lawyers. We very much appreciate your arguments. This is an important matter, and we will take it under advisement. At this time, we'll take a brief recess to reconstitute the court.